This podcast is a Majestic Giraffe production. For more information and more content, visit majesticgiraffe.com.
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
Droids are clean, the vaporizers are patched, and the speeders futilely attempt to pick up some blue milk and power converters. You're listening to Tosche Station Radio, brought to you by the Majestic Giraffe Network. Now here are your hosts for the Snarkiest Podcast in Star Wars and Geek Culture, Brian and Nancy.
On the outskirts of Anchorhead and on the shores of the Great Chott Flats, you're listening to Tosche Station Radio, the bright center in the universe for all things Star Wars and geek culture. I'm your host, Brian, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Nancy.
Hi.
On today's episode, we're chatting with Jason Fry, author of The Essential Guide to Warfare and the new Clone Wars episode guide. We're about to get started, so sit back, grab some power converters, and enjoy the show. Before we proceed too much further, a note from those who help us keep the lights on here at the blog and podcast. Tosche Station Radio is brought to you in part by Audible.com. Listeners to this podcast can get a free audiobook by signing up for a free trial. Click the link on Tosche-Station.net for more details.
And we're also brought to you in part by Her Universe. Flaunt your world with Star Wars, Star Trek, Battlestar Galactica, Doctor Who, and other fandom-inspired wardrobe and jewelry. Click the link on our blog to purchase awesome geek gear.
And what's new on the blog this week? Nothing. We need to bribe Bria to do another project. We pretty much just hit news this week.
Yep, news, well, and not a lot of it.
Well, I did work on a book review for Crucible, but I can't publish that until July, so you'll just have to take my word for it that I put some effort into the blog this week. It's actually
sure
done.
Sure you did.
Hey, I shared the document with you. You've seen it.
I haven't actually read it yet.
Oh, that's not very nice. Since there's nothing new on the blog to talk about, we're going to move right into Fixer's Flash, where we talk about the inane, geeky things we've been up to in the last week, or the last time we all got together. And it, as is customary, Nancy, we start with you.
I went to my last week of Star Wars Weekends for 2013. Let's all be sad.
Aww.
But I did have the best moment of Star Wars Weekends ever when the Clone Wars video clip broke in the middle of the Behind the Force show. And this was Sam Witwer, Darth Maul, was the guest. And they also had brought up Tom Wilson. And if you don't know who Tom Wilson is, he was Biff Tannen in Back to the Future. And he is friends with James Arnold Taylor and was in town doing a stand-up show at the Improv. So they brought him up to be one of the people doing the skit at the one of the people doing the voices at the end of the show and the skit. And so then they kept him on stage through the end of the show, and they went to show play the video, and it broke while Dave Filoni was doing the introduction. So they decided to reenact the scene in which Sam Witwer played Dave Filoni, and he does a really funny Dave Filoni impression. And then they basically had Tom Wilson pretending to be Anakin and James Arnold Taylor pretending to be Yoda. Tom Wilson picked up James and ran him across the stage saying, "It's faster to carry you, Yoda." And then at the end, after Yoda flies away, they had Sam Witwer come in and pretend to be Mace Windu, who promptly went, "Where the hell is Yoda?"
There's video of this on YouTube. I need to cut out that little segment so I can use it repeatedly on a soundboard for this show.
I want that so bad. Just that clip to just keep going, "Where the hell is Yoda?" I almost peed my pants. I was laughing so hard.
At least he didn't use the other curse that Sam Jackson is known for.
As it was, I was like, "Oh, he forgot that certain words cease to exist once you enter Disney property." But yeah, it was really, really funny. And watching Ashley's face was great because she was like, oh, I have completely lost track of the show and I don't care. So yeah, that made my year. I was kind of bummed on Sunday, but I just kept thinking of Sam Witwer saying, where the hell is Yoda, and made me happy. And other than that, I've been watching some Stargate. So this week on Brian and Nancy watch Stargate, and this would be where you would insert the Stargate theme if you had that.
Someday I will have a soundboard for this show. Someday when I have an hour or two to get it all put together.
Okay, that's
so enough. Yes, this week on Brian and Nancy Watch Stargate, we met the weird Nox, we skipped the Egyptian sex goddess, and we watched Teal'c go through Kordai, or Korai.
Yes.
Korai.
And Brian was like, hey, Armin Shimmerman is in this episode. And I said, yes, he has weird hair.
Yeah, yes, he does. You know, it was a good pair of episodes. The Nox was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And Teal'c going through Korai was... It's an episode that probably doesn't stand out in a lot of people's minds looking back at it, but it was a pretty good episode for the first season.
Yeah, it's also kind of important because it, like, kind of ends the whole, you know, Teal'c having guilt for what he's done sort of thing. And yeah, he, you know, keeps wanting to serve SG-1 and free his people and all that. But I can't remember any, like, really major episodes where they deal with Teal'c's past after that. It was kind of like the turning point of he's a different guy now. So let's move on. But yes, the Nox is a really good episode. I like it.
And we skipped Hathor. And as a couple people are pointing out in the chat, Hathor never happened.
Nope.
Nope.
Didn't
happen.
Nope.
Should I ask why it didn't happen?
Because of the Egyptian sex goddess Hathor raping Daniel.
Yeah, I'm just going to be glad I never watched that episode.
Nope, that's not cool.
So yes, that has been this week on Brian and Nancy Watch Stargate.
And we're getting close to the end of season one, and I'm maybe hoping that we can watch that one episode while I'm visiting, because I really love that episode. There but for the grace of God.
Excellent. Good one. As for me, I am reading more Kenobi. I got that advanced reader copy a little while ago. And let me just put it this way. I can't spoil anything, obviously, but this book feels like a Louis L'Amour novel, and I say that with the utmost praise because I love Louis L'Amour novels. I said this last week, but this book oozes charm. It's going to be an extreme favorite novel for a lot of people this year, and maybe a favorite over the last 5 or 6 years.
I still haven't read any further in it, but I'm hoping to get further in it when I have time on an airplane. Because I'm going on an airplane. And why am I going on an airplane, Brian?
Because you are flying out here to Seattle to hang with me for a little while because I'm apparently graduating from college.
Who gave you a degree?
That's one of life's great mysteries. Who gave me a degree?
Ugh, man. Crazy.
Just giving
people.
Them to anyone these days. So yes, that's what we're up to. And if there's no episode next week, it's because we're all various stages of jet lagged and trying to recover from a from a cross country trip.
Yep, that would be me.
Yeah. And that's it for us. But let's go ahead and go into Deke's Dirt, where we discuss news from around fandom. And we start with a bit of Star Wars books news. The James S. A. Corey Han Solo novel, part of the Empire and Rebellion series, has a title, Honor Among Thieves.
That sounds kind of cool.
I every time I hear more about this series, I get more excited.
Yes. I'm looking forward to it. I have not read the Expanse series, but I do have Leviathan's Wake on my Kindle and do eventually want to get reading to it. But Abaddon's Gate, which is the third installment, just came out. So if you're interested in catching up on James S.A. Corey works, I've heard lots of good things about them. Dunk over at Club Jade read them and really liked them. I think at least she read the first one and really liked it. So it's space opera. Yay.
And the blog, 10th Letter of the Alphabet, had a really, really cool article up last week.
Yeah, it's all about the evolution of the Star Wars logo, which you probably don't really think about it. You know, you just think of this one logo with the kind of, I don't even know how to describe the lettering, but the, you know, interconnected S and T and the R and S and that whole block lettering type of thing. But no, it showed like all different versions of the logo and how it changed over time. And it was really interesting.
Yeah, I never really realized that the logo had gone through so many typeface evolutions over the years, but if you're a typography fan or just a Star Wars history buff, go take a look at that article. It's a fantastic read, and we've got a link in the show notes. Head over to the blog at tashi-station.net to find it.
Yep, and continuing tradition started last year. Del Rey and DK and all the other Star Wars publishers are going to be involved with Star Wars Reads Day, returning October 5th. And hopefully there'll be some events near you. So you want to keep looking at StarWars.com to see what different events they have. I know a lot of the authors come out and get involved, and they have a 501st of Rebel Legion come out. So hopefully we'll have something near Orlando, and if we do, maybe I can actually troop, since it's a Star Wars books event. I can go in my EU costume.
Yeah, so we haven't seen specifics on what events are going on in what areas, but we do know it's going to happen October 5th, so keep an eye out. If it's anything like last year, you'll be hearing from both Del Rey and DK Publishing on what authors are going to be where, and if you're lucky, you might be able to catch an Expanded Universe or Star Wars reference author in your neck of the woods.
Yep.
And let's see, the Course of the Force Lightsaber Relay in support of the Make-A-Wish Foundation is back this summer, kicking off July 9th from the Skywalker Ranch and arriving in San Diego on July 16th. For $150, registrants can carry the lightsaber during the relay. All proceeds go to charity, and the Nerdist has kicked off a multi-part web series leading up to the event.
Yeah, it's a kind of a cool event. They started it last year to kind of mimic the Olympic Torch Rally, and did it to raise money for charity, and they had a good turnout, so they decided to do it again this year, and they have a... I know Ashley Eckstein was involved last year, and the Nerdist is on this year, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of the people run in costume, so if you're in California, definitely go check it out.
And in sad fandom news, Matt Smith is leaving Doctor Who after 4 years. In happier news, let's talk about all the awesome suggestions to replace him.
That's been my favorite thing about this whole thing, because I'm not a Who fan. So while I empathize with the Who fans on their sadness, I just keep hearing all the suggestions to be the next Doctor, and I'm like, I like all these ideas.
My vote's for Dame Helen Mirren.
Good option. I've also heard Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson as the Doctor would be fantastic.
I've also heard Judi Dench.
Well, that's just because Judi Dench should be in all the films.
Yes. I've heard... I cannot pronounce his name. I think it's Chiwetel Ejiofor, who was the kind of villain bounty hunter guy in Serenity, and was also in Love Actually, if you've seen that movie.
Also known as the second best Christmas movie ever, behind Die Hard.
Nope. But yeah, I'm going to be interested in hearing who actually gets cast.
But let's be honest, it's going to be another British guy none of us have heard of.
Probably, yes.
I'm going to run with that as the safe bet.
Yeah. All right. I think it would be cool if it was, you know, a British guy of color we've never heard of before. That would be kind of cool.
That would be cool, and I would be 100% behind that casting choice if they were to do that.
I've also heard of the guy... Oh, I think he's from Community, but I don't watch Community, so I don't know his name.
Can you give me an archetype?
He's kind of the nerdy guy.
Abed?
He's got Yes. I think he's got, like, longer kind of frizzy hair.
Community? Are you thinking the IT crowd?
No. Yes, I'm sorry, yes.
Okay.
The other show I don't watch. That guy.
That guy,
yes. Is that the right guy?
I'd wager that's a much closer guess than the guy from Community.
Let me look it up. I'm looking up. Nah, this doesn't happen. Yes, this guy from the IT crowd.
Name?
Richard Ayoade? Ayoade.
We are great with names on this show. Just great with names.
Yes, I think it's... Wikipedia is telling me it's Ayoade.
Okay, well, that could also be a fantastic casting choice, but we'll find out. But apparently one person that already knows who it's going to be is Will Wheaton. According to the Mary Sue. Was he trolling everybody?
Well, I mean, not that he doesn't know, but, you know,
yeah,
I'm
he's being
sure
a jerk
know.
For alluding that yeah. he knows and not telling any of us.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Come on, Will. Nobody likes you, Wesley. You and your
Wesley.
Stupid sweater vest. Go back to the bridge. Okay, well, that is Deekster this week. A brief bit of news, but right now we're heading into Cammy's Concerns, and we're going to cut away into a segment we recorded a little earlier today. We got something special for you all. We are joined by author Jason Fry, the guy behind the Essential Atlas, Essential Guide to Warfare, and a bunch of Clone Wars books.
Yes, and it was a lot of fun, and we hope you enjoy it.
All right, enjoy the interview.
And we're here with Star Wars author Jason Fry. Jason, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll start with the first question that we ask all of our guests, because we are a Star Wars podcast, which is, how did you become a Star Wars fan?
Well, I was 8 years old in May 1977. And the amazing thing looking back at that is that Star Wars wasn't Star Wars. It was just a movie. Mm-hmm. And I was an eight-year-old kid, so we just happened to be going one day. I don't think I'd even really heard about it through the elementary school grapevine. And so there I was in the theater on Long Island in Stony Brook, and I'm looking up, and then, well, you know, this little ship goes overhead, and then this absolutely giant ship goes overhead and keeps going and going and going. And I think by the time you saw the engines of the Star Destroyer, I was pretty much hooked for life. So, you know, I was a fan from the very beginning and just never put that aside. And at the same time, was already interested in telling stories and in being a writer. And so I was just lucky enough to have the two mesh. But it all goes back to, you know, being an eight-year-old kid and looking up at that and thinking, wow, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
It's kind of like the perfect age to see Star Wars for the first time.
It really is. It really is. You're not lost in the story, but it appeals to you when you can last the 2 hours. So, yeah, I was absolutely set for life.
And you said you'd already been interested in writing. So was that something you'd always like to do? And when did you start thinking, hey, I want to do this for a living, not just write stories in my spare time?
That's a good question. I don't know how far it goes back, but pretty much as soon as I could scratch out words with a pencil. My mom, when I was a kid, my mom was a college professor, and she would have those small blue exam books. They would come in these huge stacks that she would give out to her students for tests. And I would steal just kind of huge stacks of those at a time and write stories in them. And it just went from there. It went up from there to, you know, different paper and then word processors and everything like that. But I always wanted to tell stories and think stuff up. And I still do that today, whether it's The Galaxy Far, Far Away or my own stories.
So you spent 13 years writing for the Wall Street Journal online. Was that your first major writing gig? And if so, and how did that gig come about?
I had some newspaper experience before then. You can't just get there. That would be pretty rough on a new reporter. I worked for my paper in high school. I was the sports editor. I did two internships in college in New Orleans and then Fresno. And I worked for a trade publication down in Washington, D.C. For a while. It was the Indoor Air Review, of all things, which really is a real thing. And I used to joke that it was what I dreamed of doing as a child because, you know, generally get a laugh. But
what was the Indoor Air Review about?
Well, I'll tell you, this is actually, it's not as uninteresting as you might think.
Okay.
So it's not fascinating. It's about pollutants inside buildings and at the time about the problems of cigarette smoking in buildings and all that stuff. And the thing to remember is pretty much any decent-sized office building has a guy who that's a major part of his job or her job, if not the entirety of it. And so you start looking around kind of any cityscape and thinking about it that way, and you suddenly realize, you know, oh my goodness, this is an industry that's worth billions and billions of dollars. So it was not particularly entertaining writing perhaps, but it was an interesting mix of government and science and controversy and all at once. So kind of accidentally, it was actually pretty good training for being a business reporter, a technology reporter later at the Journal.
Yeah, I work for a quasi-government utility, and I write stuff like that, and it's not that exciting, but there are some things where I'm like, wow, I didn't know there was this much going into generating power.
Yeah, pretty much anything is really interesting if you get into how it ticks and how it's changing and all that. There's the world is a bizarre place. There's all these things beneath the surface that are much more complicated than you think. And I'm sure you've had this experience too. It's good training for writing. I mean, if you can make quasi-government entities or radon be relatively clear to the reader, you can do most anything else too.
Yes, that is very true.
So that is definitely a bit of a jump from writing that to getting into Star Wars. So how exactly did you get involved writing Star Wars books?
I was a fan on back on America Online when it just started.
Wow.
And one of the mind-blowing things about that, which I think we've all forgotten, those of us who were around when it first happened, because now it's just commonplace today, but it was absolutely incredible to be able to go somewhere and have, you know, dozens, hundreds of really smart fans who all love Star Wars and knew everything that was coming out and, you know, had opinions on everything. There they were, exchanging news and tips and arguing and all that. It was a prototype for so many fascinating things going on online now, and I was just amazed by it. It was heaven. And it's interesting, a lot of folks dating back to those forums are still active in Star Wars. My friend Dan Wallace was part of that, and Chris Trevis, and a whole lot of really fantastic cosplayers and other folks. So that was enormous fun, and I started, it was kind of just a hobby for me. My thing was keeping track of planets, because I was always really interested in the geography of Star Wars. But that really kind of immersed me in Star Wars again, because, you know, there was somebody to talk to about it. And so from there, I, as a hobby on the side of the journal, I started writing for the Insider. I was their books columnist, starting back in 1999. The first time I ever had was Vector Prime.
Oh.
And, you know, I had a manuscript of the book, and was like, oh my God, they're going to kill Chewbacca. This is amazing. And talked to Bob Salvador. And I've never verified this, but I think maybe they wanted to see if I could keep the secret of that. And if for some reason I hadn't, they would have just fired me on the spot. But I proved that I could keep a secret, and that led to doing the book column for the Insider, and then doing other things for the Insider. And from there, it's like anything else. The assignments got a little longer and more complex as I proved I could handle them. Then I started doing RPG stuff for Wizards, mostly for the website, but a couple of books. And then the Essential Atlas with Dan was actually in the works when the Clone Wars visual guide came out, which was my first book. So it was kind of a race to stores for that one. I forgot. There's one interesting, at least to me, kind of sidelight there. The first thing I actually got approved for was to be a writer for the old Star Wars Adventure Journal from West End Games.
Oh, yeah.
But then the damn thing folded before I ever got a chance to write for them. I was so disappointed. Because that was really so open in a way that is a little harder now. It was really so open to writers, kind of, you know, all experience levels and stripes, and that you could do so many interesting things. Yeah. So I was just crushed when that then shut down. But the good part of it was I did become friends with Craig Carey of West End Games, who turned out to be my neighbor in New York, and we'd go out and drink beer and talk Star Wars and rag on each other about our baseball teams. So a horribly long-winded way of saying how I got here.
Cool. So I read a long time ago, well, not a long time ago, but I read when you wrote a blog post about being a stormtrooper at Citi Field. And I really loved that post. So I was hoping you could tell our listeners about how that whole thing came about.
Sure. That was very funny. Like, I've always been a huge baseball fan. I co-write a baseball blog with my friend Greg Krantz called Faith and Fear and Flushing about the perennially hapless New York Mets. And of course, I've always been a huge Star Wars fan. But I also feel like the Venn diagram of those two things, like I'm the only person on Earth at the overlap, which is quite true, but it's a fairly small group. And so I've often found myself as like the ambassador between sports fans who don't get Star Wars or Star Trek or Lord of the Rings or whatever, and sci-fi or fantasy fans who don't get sports. And it leads to lots of funny conversations. Like, there'll be baseball fans who are like, wait, you know, if you're going down to Orlando and guys are going to be dressed as Boba Fett, they're like, that. And meanwhile, I'm like, you know, you appear to be wearing half of a David Wright uniform, but I'm pretty sure you're not David Wright. So, you know, you guys are really not that different.
Yeah, you know, I've often wondered what's the difference? Because what is it the difference?
Yeah, exactly.
How is it different when I go in costume to a convention or when I go to a Mariners game in a Felix Hernandez jersey?
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. And it goes the other way, too. Sometimes you get science fiction or fantasy fans, they're like, how can you get so tangled up in something out of your control with, you know, the outcome of young millionaires playing a ball game. And I'm like, you know, you're hugely upset that the General Madine died. He doesn't exist. Like, come on. Can we get along? We're not so different. Anyway, but getting back to your question. So a couple of years ago, they were having the stand-up decanter night at Citi Field, which obviously is, you know, just an awesome night and a great cause. And the Empire City Garrison here in New York City, who are super unbelievably nice guys, you know, as is all the 501st and Rebel Legion chapters. They'd been to some book signings with me and, you know, always been really helpful, and they were doing stand-up to cancer, and they were just kind enough to say, hey, do you want to go along? And I said, yeah, absolutely, let's do it. You know, let's let these two worlds mesh. But they were super kind to me. I actually have a set of Stormtrooper armor at home, but it's sitting on a mannequin. It's not really wearable. Like, all the Velcro has gone to hell, and it would be a mess. So they let me. I brought my own body glove, and a guy, Dave Braun, lent me a suit, which was really kind of him. I brought my own boots, too. But you know, the amazing thing, have either of you ever trooped? I'm sorry, I should have done this.
I actually have an approved costume, but I've never trooped yet. But I hope to start doing some this summer. I haven't actually done it.
It won't be news to you that armor is incredibly hot.
Yeah.
You cannot see anything.
Yeah, I go to Star Wars weekends all the time, and I have no idea how they march in the parade in those outfits.
No, me either. But so, you know, I had obviously put on the armor I have at home a couple of times because, well, I mean, why wouldn't you? It's crazy not to. But I had never been in a situation like this. And so, you know, I'm in the middle of a baseball stadium, and I'm, you know, clanking around. I sound like the Tin Man. And everybody else in the Empire City Garrison was pretty experienced at all this, but I was just this absolute newbie. And so we're there on the concourse, and, you know, you can't see anything below halfway down your rib cage. And it was absolutely terrifying because there were kids coming everywhere to, like, grab you and, you know, high five, et cetera. And I couldn't see them. And so I just followed. I was just following the guy right in front of me, and then we were gonna go down the field level and go on the field to throw T-shirts. And I mean, I bounded up the stairs at Citi Field, you know, 50 times. I mean, I know that ballpark pretty much by heart, but I had never looked at the railings going down the field level, and they're all broken up randomly so fans don't stack up behind each other, which makes total sense, but I couldn't see them. So I was trying to go down steps, holding onto a railing I couldn't see that would just randomly stop. And I was like, the only thing in my head was, don't fall down. Don't fall down in the armor and literally not be able to get up and have the poor Empire City Garrison stopping, you know, to get you out of this terrible mess. And I got through it just fine. And, you know, managed to sort of lamely throw a couple T-shirts in the crowd. And, you know, the video was all over the place. And I was like, well, it wasn't that bad. I'm sure it'll be fine, but I'll look at the video. Before I even saw the video, you know, somebody I vaguely knew was like, there was this one stormtrooper who was going like 2 miles an hour. And I really, we were all kind of worried he was unconscious or something. I was like, oh, no. And I looked at the video, and sure enough, I mean, it was, there was no doubt at all which one was Sage. So it was enormous fun, but it's, I'm just pretty glad I lived through it. But, yeah, I mean, for anyone who hasn't done it, I mean, the 501st Rebel Legion, beyond the fact that they send so much of their time going to, you know, things like children's hospitals and doing wonderful things, you know, until you've walked a quarter of a mile in their armor, you have no real appreciation for what they do. So it was pretty amazing.
So your latest, or sorry, I accidentally skipped a segment in my show notes. Going back up a tick. You've written a lot of books about the Clone Wars. Were you a fan of the show from the beginning, or did the books just spark your interest?
They were kind of one because I was assigned to the visual guide before the movie even came out, and the visual guide covered a good chunk of the first season and the movie. So, I mean, it was a job before I could ever see the show, but which was an odd experience. And I had never had an experience as a Star Wars author where I had scripts ahead of time. So it was very interesting having that happen. I would have been a fan anyway. I would have watched it religiously. I'm a Star Wars fan. That's what I do. But it was very interesting. At first I was like, reading the scripts ahead of time kind of spoils things, and you know all this stuff's coming out, but there's no one to talk to about it because you can't do that. And then, you know, it's months and months before it comes out, and you know it's going to happen. But what I found out was pretty interesting is that the scripts, while they obviously tell you the story and all that, they don't really capture the episodes. For two reasons. One is that, I mean, so much of the Clone Wars is still improvisational in terms of the fight sequences or how things fit together. A lot of times in scripts, you'll get something like they fight, and the distance between that and, say, the duel between Maul and Pre Vizsla in season 5 or something is enormous, and a lot of that is improvised as the show develops. So there's that, but it's also that the show is so much more than just the script and the dialogue. It's the pacing and the lighting, etc. One of my favorite episodes is Bounty, the one on Quartzsite where Asajj and Boba Fett and the other bounty hunters are protecting the train. And reading that script, I wasn't that grabbed by it, but that was because, I mean, you had no sense of the atmosphere of that, or, you know, the amazing design of the Kagi warriors and the beasts, or C-21 Heisinger, like the coolest droid in the entire show. You had none of that. And so even though I had read the script, I mean, the show was still just a really interesting experience to watch unfold. So that was a cool lesson in that I didn't forget, that the script is sort of the beginning point of what a show is. And it was nice because, I mean, to bring your question full circle, that meant that, I mean, Clone Wars was always a job, but I found that I was free to be a fan anyway because there was so much unexpected.
Yeah, it's like what you hear from the voice actors where they say, you know, because they record so early and they only record their parts, that by the time they get to watch the episode, they've forgotten what happens, or they have no idea how the show even ends or turns out because they weren't there when they recorded it.
Yeah, exactly. The one place it got kind of interesting, I adapted Darth Maul, season 5 arc as Shadow Conspiracy.
Oh, that's right. And
that was actually my second adaptation. I did the original Boba Fett arc I adapted. But the Boba Fett book is a very, very short book. I think it's 8 or 10,000 words. And The mall book was 25,000 or 30,000 words, something like that. So with the Boba Fett book, it was so short that it was, that book is almost entirely action and dialogue. There just wasn't room for anything else. But with the Maul book, that was not the case. And in fact, if that had been just dialogue and action, the book wouldn't have been long enough. Which for me was great on the one hand, because I was able to go kind of into the characters' heads in ways that the show couldn't do because it's a TV show. And also I was able to craft, there's one scene in that book that isn't in the show that I invented on my own. And so that was really fun. But the flip side of it was that I needed descriptions in ways that I hadn't in the Fett book. So I drove poor Leland Chee absolutely insane because I had to ask him, you know, scene after scene, I'd be like, what's the lighting here? What does this thing look like? What's the pacing, et cetera? So poor Leland, bless him. Leland is not only a really smart guy, but he's incredibly patient. And he just, you know, very calmly and very generously just went back and forth between me and animation, answering as many of my annoying questions as he could for that book.
And your latest book is the Clone Wars Episode Guide, which just came out. And what can you tell us about this book? And did you learn anything surprising about the series while you were writing?
Yeah, it came out Monday, I think.
Yeah.
It's a fun book. It's like all DK books. It has a beautiful design. It's full of great, great art. One of the things that's great about working for DK is, you know, whether a DK book is about the Clone Wars or about, say, you know, medieval castles, you know it just looking at it. They have such a great style in those books. So it's a very visual book for openers. I would say, in terms of the writing, in terms of the subject matter, think of it like the Clone Wars character encyclopedia for episodes. That's about the level of the writing and the level of the information there. So we'll summarize each episode. We made the decision not to give away how things turn out, because there's still a fair number of fans who haven't necessarily seen all the episodes. And so those descriptions are paired with explanations of what's going on in a scene, details about the plot, as well as little kind of pop-ups about, you know, what is this character doing in the scene? Here's a cool thing about lightsabers or warships or what have you, as well as some behind-the-scenes stuff about production or where has this design appeared before, what's this character's other adventures in the saga, or even how does this episode have been shaped by movie or TV history? What are the homages? What are the references? Things like that. I think it's a great book. I mean, I'm biased, of course, but there was a lot of work in it, but I think it's a nice companion for the series. That it's a kid's book, but I think older fans will really enjoy it too. I hope so, at least. In terms of surprises, there wasn't too much that surprised me there, but a couple of things did kind of come out in my thinking as the book progressed. One was just how rich the connections are to the rest of the saga. You know, I know this wasn't to every fan's taste, but I thought that every time Clone Wars was playing a note, whether it was a line of dialogue or a shot or just a similar situation with something that happened in the movies, I thought that was great. I thought that was enriching the larger story. So that really, looking at the episodes again, that emerged for me. The other thing was that the episode guide presents all the episodes in chronological order, which had never been done before. And seeing how they fit together that way changed that experience a little bit. In particular, the Senate episodes, I think in broadcast order, they came to seem like departures from the main thrust of the show or kind of sidebars. But when you see them together, they're a pretty good arc in their own. And they, in my opinion, work much better that way. So that was fun to see. And hopefully it's something that that fans will get from reading it, too. I mean, if you read this book, hopefully what you should want to do is queue up an episode or three or five or however many DVDs you have.
I'm really looking forward to going back and watching all the episodes in chronological order. Just to see how the story goes that way.
Particularly try the Senate episodes. Like I confess those weren't the episodes that really grabbed me in broadcast order. But, you know, looking at them from, I think it's Heroes on Both Sides starts it to through Senate Murders, they really hold together nicely. It's a pretty nice arc in a way that I didn't appreciate seeing them piecemeal and out of order.
Now, this book was originally only supposed to include the first 100 episodes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
What happened there to get it to the whole run?
All credit to DK and to Lucasfilm. Because we're in chronological order, I don't remember what it was. It was either going to wind up with the last episode was going to be the first Maul episode of season 5, and you weren't going to get the rest of the arc, or we're going to miss that entirely. And obviously that wasn't going to work. So I was pushing, and I was pushing to go beyond that. And DK very quickly came to the same conclusion. I didn't have to argue with them or convince them. They knew that too. And then we got a lot of help from Lucasfilm, particularly from Jonathan Rinzler, about how to make that work. So we were able to do all 5 seasons plus the feature film, which was great. It brought us right to the absolute end of deadlines, but we were able to pull it off, which I was very happy about. Now, the thing that's doubly interesting there is that that book wrapped before we learned that the show was done.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so I was even happier. I mean, if there had been a few episodes of season 5 not in there and that had been the case, that would have been really unfortunate.
Yeah.
And also things like in the book, I mean, relatively few people have seen it, but the last image in the book is just that great iconic image of Ahsoka walking off into the Coruscant sunset. And that was DK's designers really wanted that image as the last image, and they really pushed for that. Again, before we knew the show was concluding. And that was obviously a super smart call by them. And I'm really grateful they stood up and were like, no, we have to have this image, because it was absolutely the right call.
Absolutely. And, I suppose now we can ask you to take off your author's hat and put on your Clone Wars fan hat. How did you feel about how and where the show ultimately wound up ending?
Obviously it wasn't done. I mean, we know that because we've gotten so many peeks at the bonus content or, you know, season 6 with an asterisk or whatever you want to call it. And for the record, I don't know what's happening with that stuff. I wish I did. I haven't heard anything anybody else hasn't heard too, but I'm hugely eager to see that stuff, because I mean, there's so many stories that I want to know how they come out. I mean, it's not just Ahsoka, but Asajj Ventress, I think what they've done with that character over the show has been fascinating. I think she and Ahsoka have the most compelling journeys as characters. I really want to see what happens to both of them. And also, the clones, the show, I think some of the show's best moments have been letting us see how the clones are and are not identical. I think that's been fascinating. So, I mean, don't you want to see how Rex deals with Order 66?
Yes.
I mean, how's that going to work? That's fascinating. As well as other things that, you know, where I just get my Star Wars geek on. Like, I mean, Bo-Katan and Mandalore? What's going on there? How's that going to happen? So I'm really excited to see how it turns out, and whether that's, you know, on a DVD or streaming or whatever they're going to do. I really want to see how all those story arcs wrap up.
My pet theory for Darth Maul is that Palpatine's plan. Well, because the robot legs came from the Infinities comics. And there was another Infinities comic where he attacked the Lar homestead and Owen killed him. So my pet theory is that Palpatine's plan for him was to, attack the Lar homestead and try to kill baby Luke, and Owen kills him so they can make that canon too.
That would be cool.
Just because I think that would be fun to have the two Infinities comics actually become real canon.
That would be really cool. Yeah, I can see that. He's been so damaged by Palpatine that he's back to being kind of Savage Maul like we see in that comic. And hey, I'm for it. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I completely forgot about Darth Maul because when I did Shadow Conspiracy, they didn't say so, but my impression was that he was killed at the end of that.
Yeah.
Which was either left intentionally ambiguous in the development of the shows, or else they changed their mind or improvised or something. So it was kind of funny, having written that adaptation, I was as surprised as anyone when the dialogue turned out to be a little different. And so he says, "Oh, I'm not going to kill you." I was like, "Wait a minute, what?" So there's that one too. And let's see what happens there.
Random aside, just because you said you mentioned Asajj Ventress, and she's probably my favorite character on the show. Did you get a chance to see the Asajj Ventress at Star Wars Weekends at all?
I did. I was hurrying to something, so it was from afar, unfortunately. But
because she is so good. She does not break character. She sneers at everyone and just, you know, stares there with this look on her face. I'm like, oh, she is really, really good.
She did compliment my shoes, actually, but in a way, like, maybe I'll slice them off your feet.
So,
yeah, that was fantastic. The Ahsoka was great, too.
Yeah, she's...
I was there with my kid, and he posed with Ahsoka, which was a thrill for him. I wasn't able to... I was hoping we'd run into Ashley Eckstein, who's pretty much the nicest person on the entire planet and is such a fabulous fan ambassador. And that didn't happen, but he did get to he did stand in the action figure bubble with Ahsoka. That was awesome.
That is cool. So, moving on with more fan ideas. So they announced the new show Rebels. Do you have any fan wants that you would like to see in that show?
Huh, that's a good one.
I told you mine already, that I want to see that image of all the rebel leaders meeting together, just because I think that's an awesome image.
Yep. It's interesting. I mean, this brings up a question that I think Star Wars fans are pretty divided about, is, you know, what's your approach to Rebels? I mean, if your approach is that you're thinking of all the things in continuity that you're worried about, that's one thing. And, you know, I've written lots of books that do a fair amount of continuity heavy lifting, but, you know, I know a lot of people don't agree with me, but I don't really think about things that way. I just really, most of all, want really good stories, and good stories driven by big-hearted storytelling and interesting characters banging into each other. And, you know, if that's what we get from Rebels, that would make me, that's what would make me really happy. And if that complicates, shall we say, the construction of the Death Star or the rise of the rebellion or what have you, that would be okay with me. Just, you know, give me that, and also let me be surprised. Let me have fun with it. And you know, that's been my attitude toward Clone Wars too. I mean, certainly if they ever do a comprehensive timeline of the Clone Wars, whether it's an essential guide or something else, you know, that's going to take some spackling and some explanations, et cetera. But you know, I think personally, at when the show was at its best, that you know, the depth and the richness of the characters and the storytelling were, to me, were worth that. I'd love to know what you guys think of this, but I've gotten much more kind of loose about my expanded universe. I was thinking about Robin Hood the other day. You know, I mean, okay, so if we were going to make up a Robin Hood story, like the three of us, we pretty much get it. You know, there's Robin Hood. He wears green. He's a master archer. There's, you know, Little John and Friar Tuck and Maid Marian, and Maid Marian's the love interest. And then there's the Sheriff of Nottingham, et cetera. But, you know, if you get those things and kind of the derring do right, I mean, the other stuff is really kind of up for grabs in every retelling. I mean, sometimes Maid Marian is rescuing, and sometimes she most definitely doesn't. Sometimes Robin Hood looks like Kevin Costner with an accent that kind of comes and goes, and sometimes he looks like Errol Flynn. And, you know, oh, my God, once he looks like a fox walking on his hind legs. You know what I mean? But all the stories are recognizably Robin Hood. And if you're a fan of that, you know, to me, you just kind of relax into it and enjoy it. And I've increasingly, as a fan, come to be that way about Star Wars. You know?
I think we both have this similar opinions about it. And I think I'm much more willing to forgive like continuity errors in a book that feels like Star Wars than I am yep. in a book that either I don't like or I just think isn't in the spirit of the saga. That's when I get on the picky and I'm like, Lando and Han weren't talking together during this time period. Come on. Then if I'm like, oh, well, this is a great book, I don't care because they make it work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I think the saga has kind of gotten caught in between a little bit. You know, the continuity. I'm actually one of my secrets as a Star Wars geek is I actually know very little about other kind of shared universes, but I hear that the continuity is much tighter with Star Wars than most other franchises, which is great. But, you know, I just think back to the very first thing I saw when I was 8 years old. It was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. I mean, it's the opening line of every fairy tale. And I don't know, we don't get that hung up when the various versions of Sleeping Beauty don't intersect perfectly. So, I mean, for me, that works for Star Wars too. I mean, if for argument's sake, Luke Skywalker lived 2,000 years before all those tales are told, I mean, every planet in the galaxy would have a tale about Luke Skywalker, whether it was, you know, Luke Skywalker stopped for gas and snacks here once, and it was awesome too. You know, Luke Skywalker fought his first duel with Darth Vader here on Mimban. No, it was on Bespin. No, it was on the planet from it was on Monastery. It was, you know what I mean? That, you know, we already see that with George Washington and, you know, and Jesse James, who haven't even been dead that long. I mean, there's no possible way they did everything and were everywhere people said they were. And, you know, with Star Wars, that would just be times basically infinity. So, you know, give me a great story, give me some good characters, and let me hear the music in my head, and I'll be thrilled.
Absolutely. Something I would like to see Rebels do a little bit, though, is I wouldn't have a problem if it goes into the expanded universe and borrow things, borrow ideas, or borrow characters, because there's a lot of interesting stuff to mine from that parallel universe.
Oh, yeah. No, I absolutely agree. And I think it's interesting. I think some of the, among the hardcore fans, like some of the most interesting, but also, unfortunately, sometimes some of the hottest tempered arguments have been really about that, you know, that Clone Wars did incorporate a lot of stuff from the expanded universe, but it's how they did it. I mean, to some folks, you know, one tip of the hat or borrowing of something is, you know, is proof that the expanded universe is vital and they're happy to see that. And for others, you know, if there's a contradiction created, that ruins it for them. And yeah, I see both sides. I mean, I would never tell anybody there's a right or wrong answer for that. I mean, I think it's lousy to dictate people in anything, particularly, you know, fictional worlds that they've come to really love spending time with. But, you know, that argument I think is so fierce because the points of view are actually pretty close. You're talking about a fairly slight degree in how something is approached. But hey, that's part of the fun of fandom, I guess. You know, the vast majority of people in this world would be like, "What are you guys talking about?" But we can happily argue about it and exchange views forever, which is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I just completely lost track of my show notes again, trying to find my spot. There we are. One of our favorite reference guides you've done is The Essential Atlas, which you co-authored with Dan Wallace. Could you tell us how that project came about and what it was like trying to put all the planets in the galaxy far, far away into some semblance of order?
That book started as a dream, and I'm not kidding. I was probably 12 or 13 years old, and I dreamed that I'd been to my lousy mall bookstore, and there was the Atlas of the Star Wars Galaxy, and I'd bought it and I brought it home, and that was when I woke up. And I woke up, you know, the alarm was going off, I had to go to school or whatever. And I had that weird thing that happens to you sometimes after you wake up from a dream where you don't realize that it was a dream. And so I was awake and I was like, "Yeah, I gotta go to school, I have study hall, I'm gonna, you know, have a track meet and I have to do homework, blah, blah, blah." But it's all fine, because at the end of all that, I'm going to get to read that cool Star Wars book that I just bought, the book I'd always wanted. And then, you know, bam, I was like, "Oh, God, that book doesn't exist, does it? That was a dream." And I never forgot that, because it was so vivid. And I had no idea that I would have to be one of the two guys who would actually make it a real thing. Which was fortunate, because I, you know, of course, had no idea how much work that would be. But that just always stuck with me. And Dan and I originally proposed that book, actually to Wizards of the Coast as a role-playing book.
Oh.
I think it was going to be called The Starhopper's Guide to the Galaxy originally. But from the beginning, the idea was, the idea was there that it was going to be both, you know, both lots of maps where you could find every planet and or every sun at least, as well as look at the galaxy as a society, et cetera, through a geographic lens. So that idea was there from the beginning, and then we just kept just haranguing Del Rey about it again and again and again. Every project we did or might do, we would bring it up. And finally, I think they and Lucasfilm were like, "Oh, we got to let these guys do this book, so they'll just leave us alone."
So is that the is that the secret? Just ignored them. Each of them said yes.
if it's a good idea, it'll work. But yeah, and we went from there, and then I mean, that book took a long, long time. It got stuck behind the complete encyclopedia, a really, really awesome book that grew from one volume to three, and nearly took the sanity of a whole bunch of terrific writers and editors as it just got bigger and bigger. But that was frustrating at the time, but I was actually pretty grateful for it, because it meant that Dan and I, and, you know, this was Dan's dream come true every much as bit as it was mine, that Dan and I could just keep churning and churning and making the Atlas, you know, even bigger and better and getting more stuff into it. So it took a while, but I was just thrilled when it finally came out. But somewhere out there, I lost your other question. What was it like to do every...
How is it like putting all the planets into some semblance of order? Because I know when I'm reading the books, sometimes this planet seems like it's over here, and this planet seems like it's near this planet, and who knows?
Well, that's actually step one, is that, if you go over the Atlas and then take a fine-tooth comb to some of the books, geography, I mean, it doesn't work. And that's because, I mean, it can't work. I compared it once to, you know, if you had, say, an outline map of the United States, but you didn't know where any of the cities were, you could figure out where, say, Philadelphia was by saying, like, well, it's 100 miles from New York, and it's on the Schuylkill River, and it's this many miles from Cincinnati. And if you got enough data points, you could figure out, oh, Philadelphia's here. But where that breaks down for placing star systems in the Star Wars galaxy is that there are contradictions. It'd be like, you know, it's 100 miles from New York, but it's also 500 miles from New York. And so in some things, just Dan and I had to eventually pick and choose. And we had to make rulings. And, I mean, that was true in Essential Guide to Warfare. It's true in anything like that. Eventually you have to be like, well, you know, what's the most recent story, or in what story is it a major plot point versus a, you know, a one-off reference, or, you know, frankly, which is cooler? Or, I mean, after, of course, does Lucasfilm have a ruling? But so there was that, but it was an interesting mix of, in placing everything, I mean, to write the Atlas, I'd say probably about a third of things got placed that way. Because, I mean, you're going to populate, say, Hutt space. A lot of things happen there. You're going to populate, you know, the Hoppen cluster. Through things like that, a lot of stuff got placed. But we still had, I mean, literally thousands of star systems to place. And what we would do is, it was kind of a mix of, sometimes starting with the star system, where does this go? And then going back and looking at all the original references, always, always, always looking at the original reference and double and triple checking it. And sometimes you could kind of do a process of elimination there and figure out where it had to go or the possibilities for where you wanted it to go. And then sometimes it would be the other way around. It would be, we were filling out, say, something on the Perlemian trade route or what have you, and we wanted, say, a mining world or a slaveholder capital or a big military world or something. And then you'd do it in kind of in reverse, like, all right, what are the unplaced mining worlds? And then, again, look back at the original text and what can go here, what can't go here. And through something like that, you know, you'd wind up with, say, five mining worlds or one mining world that would work, or sometimes none. And you'd do that thousands and thousands of times, and eventually you have an Atlas.
So were you as excited as I was to see the map of the GFFA in Vector Prime when it came out the first time? I think that was the first time I'd seen a map of the Star Wars galaxy, and it just made me so excited that something like that actually existed.
That was, Dan and I, this before the Atlas was approved, Dan and I would trade, you know, our crazy fanboy emails about Star Wars stuff. And at one point I was lamenting that there was no map. And it was just so sad that there wasn't a map. And Dan was like, actually there is a map. And he and Jim Lucino had developed that map for the New Jedi Order. And he was like, there is a map. Would you like to see it? I was like, yeah, I would love to see it. And he actually faxed it to me at the Journal, and I was like hopping back and forth from one foot to the other, waiting for it to unspool. And, but of course, being a Star Wars dork like I am, like 5 minutes later, I was like, Ithor's in the wrong place. It can't be there. And Dan was like, I know, leave us alone. It needs to be there for the story. We've brought it up. Come on, cut it out. So yeah, that was an early introduction into what making the Atlas would be like. And I had a retcon for Ithor, and I eventually abandoned it. We never.
Well, you mentioned the Guide to Warfare before, and we're also we love that book. So could you tell us about how you came to work on that project? And I can imagine it was even more frustrating to try to compile all the information about the various militaries and ranking systems and everything that doesn't make any sense and try and actually making sense out of it.
It was less frustrating. I mean, not that the Atlas was frustrating. I mean, I loved everything I did.
Well, yeah.
It was just a huge job. It was daunting more than anything else. Warfare was actually easier because with 25,000 years of civilization, I knew it couldn't be comprehensive. I mean, it was impossible. It would have been a 900-page book of, you know, that would have cost $200 and frankly would have been of interest to 50 people on Earth.
I would have been one of those 50, just saying.
Oh, I would have too. Yeah. And but, you know, that's unfortunately not a mass market item. But so that was freeing in a way. I knew from the very beginning it would be a survey, if you will. I mean, a survey that had to hit all the important points, but I knew it wouldn't be comprehensive. And so two things happened there. I mean, one, it was very freeing on the one hand because I knew I could kind of dip in and range around, and that really dictated the format of the book. From the very beginning, I wanted big chapters that were divided into kind of small chunks. I also thought that would make it a lot more readable, particularly if you're a casual fan. You know, 200 pages about 25,000 years of warfare in a made-up galaxy, that's a little daunting. And I wanted to constantly break up the subject matter and the points of view and things like that so that you could kind of dip in and out of it. So that was helpful. I also, from the beginning, you know, I was talking to fans on the various forums, et cetera, and I tried to make very clear kind of what that book would be and wouldn't be, because I knew that everyone had their own favorites and their own point of view on what that book would ideally be for them. And I knew that, you know, I deliver on some of that, but for some people, it wasn't the book they had in mind. So, excuse me, I thought the way to do that was just to be upfront about it, that, you know, no, this is not, unfortunately, you know, length and hyperspace capabilities and firepower of every warship in the galaxy. That would be awesome, but that's not what this book is. Similarly, you know, this isn't a hardcore kind of inside the strategy of every military campaign. Also a very cool book, but not what it was. So I tried to approach it that way so that folks knew kind of what it was and would approach it on its own terms. How I got into the book that was interesting, I mean, that was originally going to be a Karen Travis book. It was going to be The Essential Guide to the Military. And then when Karen went in another direction, that book was up for grabs. And I was very happy to take it over, but I also one of the first things I did was I didn't want it to be the essential guide to the military, because I thought that sounded like a very different book. I thought that sounded like a very hardcore kind of manual, which was not what I wanted to write. That was one thing, and I also thought that changing the title would make it stop being the book that people had thought of as Karen's project. And I thought that was more fair to me. I thought it was more fair to the book. And also, I honestly thought it was more fair to Karen that, you know, that when that happened, that book had to stand on its own and be reconceptualized from whatever fans were expecting it to be. And so I thought that was a nice way of doing that.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about the book is that it has a lot of the technical information, but then it has the war profiles.
Oh, those war portraits are my absolute favorite piece of the book.
Yeah, I love that they have it like written by other people, like in universe. Like, I can't remember now if it's the Fell profile that's written by Wedge or the Wedge profile that's written by Fell.
Yeah, Wedge writes. It's as told to. Wedge doing Fell. Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that. I wondered if I think I went kind of right up to the edge of overdoing that and maybe beyond it a couple of places. But I was interested in kind of playing with the idea of reliable narrators, partially because, I mean, to be perfectly honest, it's a handy continuity hedge. If you're starting from someone's point of view, then you don't need to. It kind of takes people out of kind of getting their calipers out and comparing one source to the other. But I also thought it would just be fun, and I thought it would be a cool way to kind of tell different stories and frankly to approach really well-known characters and situations differently. I mean, you know, if you're a hardcore fan, you've read probably, you know, 10 different profiles of Baron Fell somehow, and another one just frankly wasn't going to be interesting for me or I thought for anybody else. So I thought the point of view helped with that. I mean, if we're going to talk about the New Jedi Order or Admiral Dalla or, you know, or Fell or anybody else, let's do it this way so that you have a different perspective on it. So, and it was also just really fun to do.
Yeah, I gotta just echo Nancy. I absolutely loved the Wedge doing the profile of Fell. So a lot of props there.
Yeah, I think I saw that and I was like, that is so awesome.
Thanks. It was you know, it was fun to get to play with some characters I really loved, like Darhan, the crazy. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right. The crazy living gun. That's a series that's overlooked sometimes, or frankly isn't some fans' favorites. But I think there's the KW Jeter Mandalorian Wars series. But I think there's some stuff in that series that is just amazing. That crazy climactic showdown between the bounty hunters and the shell huts and the spider-like info chance and all that. So things like that. Like that was really, really fun to delve into that character. And I just spent the time, I just wrote it and then just prayed that nobody else would get there before me. I got lucky on that one.
Now, sorry, go ahead, Nancy.
Oh, you go ahead.
Before we let you go, you've got an upcoming middle grade book called The Jupiter Pirates.
Yep.
Coming out. Can you tell us about it and any other projects you might have in the pipeline?
Yeah, no, happy to. Thank you for asking. The Jupiter Pirates is my own series. It comes out December 23rd, the first book from HarperCollins, so just in time for Christmas. It's a young adult book, but I think as with lots of these things, I mean, you can be 10 and read this book, but I think if you're 50, you'll enjoy it too. It's set in the 29th century and in our solar system, and the characters are a family of space pirates, though they're actually privateers. Piracy has been outlawed, and they've gone sort of quasi legit. And Earth is the adversary in this. Earth is the economic power bleeding its colonies dry, and so they raid Earth's shipping. Who doesn't love pirates? So it's space pirates. There's treasures and fights and, you know, boarding enemy ships and all the stuff that, you know, makes you want to yell "Arr!" which is hugely fun to write. But the other part of it is that the crew of the ship is a family. The mother is the captain. The father is the first mate.
Oh, I love that, children, by the way.
Oh, cool. And the children are officers. And the captaincy is handed down from one generation to the other. So the kids are working together, but they're also competitors because only one of them will be the next captain. So, you know, that's kind of the engine that makes that will make the series go as it unfolds over several books. So it's been really, really fun to write. And the folks at Harper have been great to work with. And I'm really excited for it to come out. And I hope Star Wars fans will give it a chance. It's not Star Wars, but, it definitely has, as you might imagine, for someone who's been a Star Wars fan since he was 8, I hope it's got some of that same daring do and family dynamics and all the fun stuff that we all love.
I know, I definitely want to read that. And that just kind of makes me want a Star Wars story set with Booster Tarek when his daughter Mirax is like a little kid.
Ooh, that would be good. That would be good. Yeah, I love those characters. I did. I did get to do a little Star Wars piracy. I have a story, and I think it's September's Insider that stars Hondo and Naka, which is
was
really, oh, it's so much fun to write. But it's funny. His Hondo's voice is really hard. You think his dialogue is all kind of one thing, but it's not. It's very interesting, and it's really a huge compliment to Jim Cummings, the great voice actor who does Hondo, that I would just have to stop and I would have to say things kind of in Jim's voice in my head and see if lines worked based on that, and, you know, rewrite them accordingly or occasionally even pat myself on the back. But yeah, that was a really fun story to write. I hope folks will like it.
Awesome. And finally, Jesse over at the Star Wars Book Report wants us to ask you, what did you think of the Mets sweeping the Yanks?
Well, yeah, we blew up the Death Star. It was awesome. It was fantastic. And then, of course, we got swept by the Marlins, who, you know, are the only team more hapless than us.
Yeah, that's okay. My team got swept by the Astros.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Yeah, the Astros and the Marlins are more hapless than us. But hey, you know, that's the joy of sports. You might get a stirring epic, or you might get tragedy, or occasionally you get some appalling slapstick farce.
Now, my mom is a big Yankees fan because we're from New York, and I love talking to her whenever the Yankees are doing bad, because she gets so mad at them and starts cursing.
Yeah,
she's like,
yeah,
"You guys don't deserve to win, you assholes." And I'm like, "Oh my God, Mom, you're hilarious."
Well, Jason, we can't thank you enough for coming on with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. This has been enormous fun. It was my pleasure, and I'm really honored and flattered you'd have me on. So thank you.
And where can people find you online?
You can check me out at jasonfry.net, or if you can go to trying to think. Is it jasonfry.tumblr.com? It's Jason Fry's Dorkery is the name of my Tumblr. Anyway, or, you know, check me out on Twitter. It's Jason C. Fry. Jason Fry is actually a very smart and extremely patient mobile programmer in the UK. don't bug him, though he actually knows his Star Wars really well, and he's a super nice guy. But so bug him if you want, but just know that it's not me. Or come look me up on Facebook. But either way, I'm always happy to talk Star Wars with anyone and everyone, and really, it's this saga is enormous fun. That's the thing that drew every one of us to it in the first place, and it's the thing that keeps us being fans. So come check me out any of those places, and thanks to everybody for reading.
Awesome, and thank you again. We're definitely looking forward to getting this podcast out to our listeners.
Awesome. No, it was super fun. Anytime, guys.
We want to thank author Jason Fry for coming on the podcast with us. We had a great time chatting about Star Wars, and hopefully he'll be on the podcast again soon.
And with that, we're going to move into our final segment, Ask Us Anything, and we only have a lone question this week. Justin from Twitter asks us, what would you do if it was announced that Joss Whedon was going to write and direct an X-Wing standalone film?
I would immediately hold a wake for all the dead characters.
We're going to have a preemptive wake?
Yes.
Okay, that's probably smart. But after that, I'd be very, very, very excited.
I'd be very excited, but I'd also hope that they weren't adapting pre-existing movies, because I could only imagine Iron Fist as directed by Joss Whedon.
Oh.
I gave you a sad, didn't I?
Oh, you gave me a major sad.
That's what you get for wanting Joss Whedon.
And on that bombshell, we're going to go ahead and wrap up the show. This episode of Tosche Station Radio has been brought to you in part by Her Universe and Audible.com. Get cool, geeky products and a free trial to get some neato audiobooks, including things like the 20th anniversary edition of Heir to the Empire, just by heading over to the blog, Tosche-Station.net, and clicking on the links on the sidebar. On Twitter, you can find us with the handles at Tosche_Station. That's the official show account. You can find Nancy with at Nancy Pants. That's Nancy with an I. You can find me with at Lane Winry, LaneWinree. On Facebook, we're the Tosche Station Network. We're available on the iTunes Store. If you like what you hear, please do leave us a review. It does help us grow the show. You can find our columns and news at Tosche-Station.net. That's the official blog of the show. And thanks for listening to another episode. We will catch you next time. This podcast has been brought to you by Majestic Giraffe Productions and is the official podcast of TosheStation.net. All Star Wars names, music, and logos are property of their respective trademark and copyright holders. Tosche Station Radio is not endorsed by Lucasfilm or any division of the company. Now go pick up some power converters.